Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Ooh, yeah. Happy Thursday. I'm Austin Cross filling in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. Oh, always the best music. Well, now we're going to take a look at an early history of an industry that's very close to our hearts and minds, close to everyone here at KPCC, and that is, of course, public radio. What else? It is the subject of a new book spotlighting four of the so-called mothers of NPR. That's Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, and, of course, Cokie Roberts. Now, these four influential voices helped the organization, celebrating its 50th birthday this year, by the way, to become the major news media power player it is today. Joining me to discuss is Lisa Napoli, journalist and author of the new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. Welcome, Lisa.
There, Austin.
Well, your book, Lisa, is named, of course, as I mentioned, after Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, and the late Cokie Roberts. Why did you want to tell this early story of NPR through these four women?
Well, you know, my last book was about the origin story of CNN, the first all-news network, and how it came to be in 1980. And I was looking around for my next project, and when I realized that this is the 50th year of public radio's beginning to broadcast, National Public Radio's first broadcast was May 3rd, 1971, with All Things Considered, I thought, that's interesting. And then when I realized that the founding mothers, who most people in public radio and many people beyond know call themselves that, four friends who were together for a long time on the air and outside of work, it just seemed like such a great story. Because I love Austin talking about how things come to be. I think it's really important that we look at history, especially media history, in this day and age. And even though I've worked in radio and all media for my entire career, I just didn't know how public radio started. So that's why.
Well, you know, it's hard for us to think about now, especially being in public radio, because we commonly refer to the NPR headquarters in DC as the mothership. But in the early days, you know this, but in the early days of public radio, you say it was kind of more like a startup. I was watching your conversation with the ladies that was put on by the U.S. National Archives just the other day. Can you paint a picture for us about what that startup kind of setting was?
It was classic startup, except for the garage, you know, when we think of the Silicon Valley startups. It was really scrappy. It really was invented out of thin air. Radio, of course, had been around for quite some time before public radio started, but it wasn't something they started with a sense of vision. They didn't know when they started that it would become what it is today, that people would go to college and graduate school to study audio production. Basically, they were just sort of a sideline from public broadcast, from public television, and they knew that they wanted to provide some sort of service, and they didn't really know how that was going to happen. So classic startup, they hired whoever was willing to work for cheap and long hours and who would, you know, be willing to deal with the amorphousness of it all. And as is always the case with startups, I certainly found that with CNN, whoever started it at the beginning left an indelible imprint. Of course, unlike with CNN, the case here is that Susan Stamberg and Linda Wertheimer, who were there from the very, very beginning, have stuck around and really helped shape and define what got covered. And more importantly, Austin, the tone. The tone was something they decidedly wanted to create from the very beginning that wasn't mimicking commercial broadcasting and that voice on the mountaintop. They wanted, you know, people to be talking normally, naturally, and tell stories from places that they didn't get to hear otherwise. So that was just part of their mandate, but that was really the only mandate they had. They just knew that they had to figure it out and make it up as they went. And they did it with one show. And now, of course, I don't have to tell you or anybody who's listening how dependent people have become on it as a news source.
you know, I certainly understand that. It's almost like, would you call it the voice of God that was happening on the commercial radio at the time? I came from CBS radio before I was here, and there's certainly a difference in the culture and the approach. Of course, you know, CBS radio is many, many decades old, and, you know, they were covering World War II. You know, they go back, and so they have an approach. My guest right now is Lisa Napoli, journalist and author of the new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR. And if you have questions for Lisa or you want to share your thoughts on the early days of NPR, maybe you listened, I would love to hear if there is something that you remember from those days. We are taking your calls at 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. And Lisa, I want to come back to this idea of the startup sort of culture, because NPR did need bodies. They needed people to cover these stories, of course, and they didn't have a whole lot of money to work with. And in a way, it kind of seems like it provided this back door to people who might not have gotten broadcast jobs ordinarily, right?
Yes, that was the other thing that I found so interesting. And, you know, of course, I knew that the opportunities for women had been limited in previous generations, but I didn't know until I started writing this book that these four women in particular, all women, had a hard time getting jobs. And in journalism, it was impossible to get a job on the air. You might get a job as a weather girl or covering women's issues. Maybe a byline in a newspaper meant that you'd cover society and weddings and junk like that. But it was hard for a woman who was ambitious to cover something other than that to get the job. So what was so great, and this really is one of those perfect storm stories, these particular women happened to show up in the earliest days of NPR before there were job titles, really. And they just were able to get their hands in and do whatever they needed to do, wanted to do to get stuff on the air. And nobody discriminated because nobody could afford to say, as they did at CBS Radio, where Linda Wertheimer worked before she came to NPR, well, women can't get on the air. So you can be a producer doing features, but you'll never, ever, ever cover news here. And that's what all four women had heard in their early parts of their career, was that women were just not welcome on the air. They weren't authoritative enough. So because NPR was a startup and didn't have any skin in the game, there was no preformed notion of what it should sound like or you know, who they should hire. And because there were some open-minded people behind the scenes at that point, that's how these women were able to make the inroads that they did. And in so doing, helped define the way the play sounded. They could all have been producers if they wanted to and probably run the show, but they all were fiercely interested in telling stories.
You know, in just a few minutes, I want to ask you so much more about them. But since we're on the topic of early NPR, I'm trying to think of what the media landscape looked like 50 years ago. And I know there was, of course, yeah, Boss Radio, which kind of featured these very strong personalities who sometimes they'd be shouting into the mic at you. You know, they'd be playing the top hits. And then along comes the station that I think it was described as like Montessori school on the radio. And they talk in normal voices. And I think I even remember one of the women who you had in your conversation, they worked together and they had to sometimes remind each other, just be yourself. Just, you know, be normal. Don't try to be anything else. What was the thought when NPR was created? What was the idea for this station, as my producer Natalie points out, where the style of speaking is now kind of parodied? But what was the approach at that time?
Well, you know, it's funny. It is so hard for us to imagine that commercial radio was relegated to AM back when NPR was starting and FM was just coming up. It was sort of this little fringy part of the radio. And they just made it. Bill Siemering is acknowledged as the founding father of public radio. He was there for a few years at the very beginning, and he really didn't want it to mimic commercial broadcasting, which was, of course, the whole point of public broadcasting, was that it wasn't going to sound or look in any way what they saw and heard, what people saw and heard in commercial media. And Bill had this very, very concrete vision. As I say, it was not about shows in particular, but it was that he wanted a vision. He had a vision that the sound of the radio would be different and more conversational and intimate, all the things that we love about radio. And that, of course, yes, now, of course, it's parodied and people study how to sound like Ira Glass, and they go to college to get their master's degree in audio production so that they can make these sound-rich pieces. But that was something that just was invented. And back to the media landscape question that you wisely asked, in the 70s, really, there was no news junkie universe. You know, you got your news at dinner time on television, maybe at the top of the hour or the bottom of the hour in a clip on commercial radio, and you read the newspaper at night or the morning, depending on what town you grew up in and what was available. But it wasn't the concept of a constant ecosystem of news, partially because of the technology and partially because nobody thought anybody would care. So when NPR started, it just started this evening news show. They thought evening was better than morning, because if they did the morning, they'd have to wake up really early and get to work and do that. We've all done that in the business, right? So they figured the evening show is good, and we'll feed it out at 5 o'clock, and we'll, you know, feed it out to the few member stations that existed at the time. They're only about 90. And, you know, we'll hopefully enlist them to help us. Although nobody had the equipment then. There weren't even people like you who had come from commercial radio to populate the place. It wasn't like there was a whole ready stable of people. And certainly those who did have experience didn't want to risk their careers on coming to a place that might not last. So it really was a whole different universe. And even the people listening who remember that universe probably can't remember it at this stage, because God knows there's endless streams of information coming at us from every direction.
And I'm hoping some people remember it. I'm talking with Lisa Napoli, journalist and author of the new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. We're going to be back in just a second, but if you have questions for Lisa, if you want to share your thoughts on the early days of NPR, we're taking your calls. 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. You can tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross in for Larry Mantle today. And I'm here with Lisa Napoli, journalist and author of Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR. If you have questions for Lisa or want to share your thoughts with us about the early days of NPR or maybe one of your favorite extraordinary founding mothers, we'd like to hear about it. 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. To Lisa, something that I found so interesting from your recent conversation with all of those ladies is that they created their own sort of women's network in DC to help each other get jobs, which is so incredible to think about, because at such a time when there is so much discrimination, both in the field and in the office, there's this kind of underground network of women working together to help boost each other up. How did that work?
Well, once these women got themselves in the door at NPR, they realized that they couldn't stop there, that they needed to help other women get jobs too. And the whole idea is the same conversation we have today about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that is, you know, if women were behind the microphone, then different stories would get covered. And it was just good for everyone if women had a voice and were represented. And so instead of jealously sniping at one another, I mean, Linda Wertheimer says she could have freaked out when Koki Roberts walked in the door, having come from a vaunted political family, and maybe taking her job. Instead, they wound up working together. They tag teamed, and they wanted that to cascade out of their own workplace into DC and into the profession. And so when, you know, they get together for lunch, they called it the old girls club, just like the old boys club. It's funny, you know, if you think about, it's not funny, if you think that the National Press Club used to be off limits to women, not just as a drinking establishment, you know, where you went after work, but because news was broken at the National Press Club and women couldn't get in. Eventually they were allowed to come up to the balcony and watch if a head of state was visiting or something like that. But these women all worked at that time and saw that happened and saw that change and saw things opened up. So they were militant, not in the sense of walking with signs or protesting as many women were doing at the time, but in the sense of passing the microphone to one another, if you will, to show that, you know, we'll help you get work. We'll help you out with your complicated, you know, women were just becoming used to the idea of having to juggle a career, as well as families. Of course, working class people had been juggling that forever, but these were educated women who had this entree into the profession, and they knew it was a lot harder for them than it was for the men, many of whom had wives at home taking care of the household. So they wanted to make sure they looked out for each other, and they did. They did.
I'm not sure they knew it at the time, but because it was such an early stage for NPR, because it was like a startup, the first people that a company hires usually play such a large role in determining the corporate culture that goes forward and really shaping how the company is going to operate internally and how people are going to treat each other. Now, NPR is no longer an underdog, but I'm kind of wondering if you can sum it up. How did the contributions of Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie grow public media into what it is today?
Well, you know, of course, you never really know what would have happened. But if there hadn't been Bill Siemering at the beginning, who was open, and if there hadn't been producers behind him who recognized that Susan's voice was the warmest, that she was the best person for the job, whether she was a woman or not, and she set this incredible, warm, humane tone to the program at the very outset, if that hadn't happened, it might have mimicked CBS radio. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it wouldn't have been what we know of it today. So it would have just trended in a completely different direction. And I think because these women were so committed to telling stories and sounding like people, not announcers, that really helped cascade through the network at the beginning. Of course, there were many men there. It's very important to point out it wasn't just these four women, but there were many people also who shared that vision. If you can have a vision on the radio, I guess you can.
I think you can.
Because of that. Yeah. And that's why we're all so enamored of the medium, I think. And yeah, there's a lot to be grateful to them.
Jerry from North Dakota says, I used to listen to All Things Considered on shortwave. Content was great. 1 hour from ATC. They would also get a great variety of news programs in general. I didn't have FM for the longest time, so getting the show on the shortwave was great. Just about 20 seconds left there, Lisa, but I want to ask, was there anything that surprised you in your course of research for this?
How no one has ever told this story before about braiding together the women's movement of the 70s, the birth of public radio, married with these four women's incredible history and dug into their histories. History matters, so I'm grateful to share it with you.
You dug into it, and we're so very glad you did. That was Lisa Napoli, journalist and author of the new book, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie, the extraordinary story of the founding mothers of NPR, and we love them so much here. I'm Austin Cross, filling in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. Thanks for listening, and hey, have a great afternoon.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.